About 1 in 5 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo is currently displaced. That on top of the millions who have died, largely because of fighting that has been ongoing there since 1994. Joining us now on today's Underreported is UNICEF Ambassador Mia Farrow, who's just returned from a trip to the DRC on behalf of that organization. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you very much.
How long were you in Congo, and when did you return?
3 days, and I just returned yesterday.
We've talked mostly about Darfur in the past. Had you been to the DRC before?
I never have, and I've been hearing about it. And I think you probably know now 5 million people have died there. As you said, since 1994, the Rwandan genocide, the spillover of that effect in the eastern Congo has been a profound one. So what's there is just a vacuum of justice, no viable system whatsoever, and within that, the murderous militias are just rampaging for land, for resources, with the civilian population caught in the crossfires, on the move. So people are in flight mode, just going from place to place. I spoke to people who had been displaced more than 10 or 12 times, and of course they have nothing. So it is a desperate situation. But unlike Darfur, which, as you said, we've spoken about before, this one seems doable. You don't have Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir now. The ICC is seeking an indictment for Omar al-Bashir for the crime of genocide. Here, it's simply inept and weak government, troops loose, armed, and drunk, and then these militia from Rwanda, Hutu, Tutsis, and then other just indigenous militia who've joined up because there are weapons, and then all the plundering and the savagery of it, the rape, the murder, abductions of children, and the peril for every civilian and aid worker in the region.
Well, this has resulted in the most people to die since World War II,
right.
And yet you say that peace is doable. Well, I've been reporting on the DRC for years now and talking about this crisis as it's developed. I'm not saying that I should have changed government policy, but I would have thought that if I'm talking about it, other people are aware of it, and yet the situation doesn't seem to have improved at all.
Right. And you know, I think everybody knows there are guerrillas in that part of the world. If it was the entire guerrilla population at risk, or better yet, puppies, people would have had the will to do something. Somehow, because it's human beings at risk, the international community has been very weak in its efforts to pursue a halt to the violence and a restoration of the rule of law. I mean, armed groups can and should be pressed to withdraw. And those countries that are funding them, supporting them, supplying them with arms, can and should be pressed to cease that. I mean, foreign funding of armed groups must be withheld. And then you could begin to rebuild infrastructure, schools, health centers. There is no accountability there. So, you know, one would wish to see from our country and from the international community envoys, top-level envoys there pursuing a peace process.
Well, what did you do most of the time when you were at the DRC?
Well, I just tried to absorb everything that I could see. You know, I traveled with UNICEF, and I flew with UN peacekeepers. One image I can convey out of many is pressed against the gates and walls of the UN peacekeeping compound were some 10,000 civilians just seeking relative safety from the peacekeepers. They'd been driven from their homes and the fields that sustained them. They had no access to food, no way to go home. In fact, Tutsi militia had driven them off, guns and bayonets, but they had returned to the gates. And wandering among them, I was struck by how many children were clearly sick, coughing, eye infections, and worse, in varying stages of severe malnutrition. People came to me with infants and children in their arms, just dangling little stick figures holding them out to me, it was a sight that Dante himself would surely shudder at.
Is a big part of your role as a UNICEF ambassador to witness this and talk to people and then come back to the United States and tell us what you've learned?
Right, be a messenger. Be, you know, everywhere I went, and you know, people begged me to tell the world what was happening, as if, you know, somehow if the world knew, they would take action. You know, and I've memorized the accounts. I'll give you one. A woman named Bernadette told me, "My life is completely destroyed. My insides are destroyed. They came into my home in the night. They forced the door open. My husband was away. I was pregnant. They raped me. I lost the baby and developed fistula. I became very sick. My husband left me. Aid workers carried me here." I mean, these stories over and over again, people talking about killings in the night, waking up to the sound of gunfire, talking about, and they didn't even need to say how traumatized they are and their children are. A woman said, a 27-year-old woman named Valerie said, "Parents and children are disappearing. There are killings in the night. We don't know where our children have gone. Every night, someone disappears. Thousands have disappeared. Girls and their mothers are raped in their homes in front of family members. Boys and men are kidnapped." I mean, I have countless stories, people of terror, horror stories. And they hope that if I come back and I have the opportunity to tell you, that people will understand that something terrible is happening in the eastern part of Congo. It's called North Kivu. And maybe the world will do something.
Well, there's a difference in having somebody tell this to you directly or reading about it in a newspaper or even listening to it on the radio from an eyewitness like you. And maybe that's part of the problem, the disconnect. There's an article in the December 29th issue of The Nation that said that if you look at the war in the DRC from the outside, it's hard to see it as anything but a war against women. You've
right.
mentioned a number of times rape and sexual violence.
Right.
What makes it such an effective war crime?
You know, I think to call it a war crime, which of course it is, a weapon of war is massively understating what's going on there. It's a rampage, and in this cross currents of violence, these rebel groups just do it. And it begs the larger question of why? What is it in our nature that leads us to this? And the brutality of the rapes, I mean, using bayonets and so forth. And the youngest rape victim that I spoke to was 10, and she looked younger, but I was told that babies, one-year-olds, are being raped everywhere by everyone.
So it doesn't matter whether it's this rebel group or that rebel group, they're all doing it?
They're all doing it.
Isn't rape a major stigma in the DRC? Don't mm-hmm. rape survivors become outcasts, even though
right.
they're the victims?
Right, they do. So those that are raped and are able to conceal it might very well do so. It's hugely underreported. But unfortunately, given the savagery of the rapes, as I described, with weapons and so forth, that many women, I mean, the one of the few functioning hospitals said the cases of fistula were just, they couldn't deal with it on a daily basis.
Now, fistula occurs usually in an underdeveloped body. It's when a woman is pregnant and there is,
No, they don't have to be pregnant. It's when the rape is so savage that it tears apart a woman's insides.
Hmm.
And the result is incontinence and terrible pain, and they can die because it can also be accompanying infection. But it's another byproduct of this anarchic atmosphere where women and children are profoundly at risk, profoundly. So, you know, I mean, I know I can't convey in words what I saw there, and I'll be posting pictures, and obviously the UNICEF website will have stuff. But, I mean, we all of us have to respond in some way, and what we want from our government and from the governments of the world is what the people are begging for, protection.
Go ahead.
Pardon? No, that's it. I mean, there can be no more visceral plea from the human heart than protect us. We're not safe.
Well, we have a slideshow on our website as well. So I guess we're sharing some of the things that you've brought back. I did read in that article in The Nation that some women are beginning to fight back, holding survivors' meetings, going to humanitarian aid organizations for help, and getting some counseling. But
well, you know what else? The American Bar Association is there at one of the centers where victims of rape are taken and where these surgeries for they're trying to put them back together. American Bar Association pursued, I know it's a tiny number compared to the magnitude of the attacks, but they were successfully got 12 prosecutions since last January. And it's significant because even if it's symbolic, the word is that, you know, in some cases, some people will be caught. And I love that they're there. That was a complete surprise to me.
I understand that. Well, you mentioned that children have been raped, even infants. But what about the children just trying to live normal lives? Do they have any access to schools? Are they being fed in a way that would prevent malnutrition?
Well, there's UNICEF really struggling to sustain them and to get the children back to school. But the schools, many of them are being occupied by people on the move, schools, churches, and people living outside in the forests. And those schools that where they have clear, some of them clear out in the daytime so that children can go to school, and then at night they fill with displaced people. I've never seen anything quite like it in terms of, you know, just a bleak scenario of hellish circumstances.
What about the children who are the products of rape? Are they also stigmatized?
I don't know what happens to the children who are products of rape. You know, in Sudan and Chad, so many of them are just disappear. The mothers say, unfortunately, the child did not survive. I don't know. I don't know. I didn't ask. It's very a delicate subject. I don't know. Can't tell you. But I do know that the other thing about the violations of children is the abduction into the armed groups. Little boys taken into conflict, you know, torn out of their mother's arms, torn out of their homes, torn out of schools, and pulled into armed militias.
My guest is Mia Farrow, who just returned from a visit to Congo to witness what's going on in the troubled area of North Kivu. It's my sense that Congo has there are a number of reasons for this terrible situation. Part of it is just where the fact that Congo is so rich with natural resources and that it has so many neighbors who have are troubled in their own.
Mm-hmm.
Can
yeah.
you give us a little recap in case listeners are not familiar with the background of what's been happening since 1994?
Sure. 1994 was the year of the Rwandan genocide, and Rwanda is the near neighbor of eastern DRC, or North Kivu, which is the province that abuts Rwanda. During and after the genocide, both Hutu, the genocide involved the two tribes in Rwanda, Hutu and Tutsi. It was the Hutu population killing the Tutsis and moderate Hutus. During and after that time, many fled into northern Kivu, where they took up residence in armed groups. So those are two of the groups. Two of the many groups ranging through the region, but armed and dangerous.
And then there was also the dictator of Congo, Mobutu Sese Seko, who was overthrown in 1997 by Laurent Kabila. Soon his former allies turned against him, and the fighting followed. There was an election more recently. Kabila had been assassinated. His son is now the president, and he doesn't seem to be able to resolve anything. But it's the newspapers report that part of the problem is that most of the people involved in the fighting are proxy groups fighting for larger entities, competing governments.
Well, yeah, and the region is mineral rich. There's everything there, from diamonds and gold to uranium and tin, all kinds of resources that are being plundered by all kinds of people. So you have the the groups being supported by neighboring countries, including, well, the UN report recently made a very good case against Rwanda, though the Rwandan government's denying supporting the Tutsi group there. The Hutu group is being supported by the government.
And then Uganda is involved?
Right.
Another neighbor? Because
so
they want a piece of the action?
Right. So the government, I mean, I guess, well, if one could wave a wand, you would wish, the international community to step up and provide security for the people, but also find some sort of agreement that causes the rebel groups to be disarmed, disbanded, dispersed, and the government strengthened, the rule of law strengthened. But I'm not a politician, and for UNICEF, our focus is on the women and children mainly. But it's impossible to think of them without thinking of protection.
Well, North Kivu residents recently told the press that they blame the UN mission there for the escalation of violence, that the UN mission is actually fighting on behalf of the rebels, and that they've lost trust in the ability of the UN peacekeeping mission to do much to protect them.
No, the UN mission isn't fighting on behalf of the rebels, but the disappointment from the people would be because that the UN mission has not adequately protected them. They're not actively fighting against or for any particular group. Their mandate is supposed to be to protect civilians and humanitarians. And as the recent massacre has shown of at least 150 civilians, very near the peacekeeping compound. So that UN peacekeeping mission has come under severe criticism, whether it's an interpretation of the mandate or weak leadership from contributing troop countries in terms of what they're telling their peacekeepers. I'm really not equipped to say, but the peacekeeping mission definitely needs improvements must be made because they're just not protecting people adequately.
What about these refugee camps? You have visited the refugee camps of Darfuri refugees in Chad and in Sudan as well. Are all refugee camps the same in some ways?
There is no place more bleak on this planet than camps for displaced people. They, the people, above all, they want to go home. Most of them had small businesses or fields. They had homes. They had communities. They had lives. Children went to school. They had ways of sustaining themselves. So people who are displaced are the saddest, most forlorn and desperate people on earth. Also, they're living in tents, makeshift shelters, so their health is at risk. There's a cholera epidemic. I saw Doctors Without Borders, MSF, compound on the outskirts of one of these camps where 65,000 displaced people were sheltering, and they were dealing with 300 to 400 cases of cholera a week.
Is this the cholera epidemic that originated in Zimbabwe spreading?
No, that's a separate cholera epidemic. It comes from people not being able to drink clean water and can't live in circumstances that are, healthy. So outbreaks of cholera, it's a separate outbreak, nothing to do with the Zimbabwean outbreak of cholera. But again, when circumstances are reduced to the point where people are, drinking mud and living with open sewerage and, there are no health centers functioning, there's a breakdown of a system, of all health systems. So cholera comes, stalks the people, and every other kind of disease.
Was it dangerous for you to travel in places where cholera might be? Is there something like a cholera vaccine that you can take?
No. And the thing is, the people, because they're on the move, with the carriers or whoever, whatever disease they're carrying, they move to another site. This very site that was being attacked by militias. The women said every night armed groups would come in and rape women and children. That's where I was told, babies as young as one. So humanitarian agencies were moving those who wished to be moved to a relatively safer site. But the cholera was at the site. Now, that means those that hadn't been diagnosed were moving. So on the move, they would take the cholera with them. And so it's very difficult to contain cholera or any other disease under these kind of circumstances.
Ben Affleck recently directed a film for the UN about refugees in Congo. Are you heartened to see celebrities other than yourself, like Angelina Jolie, Ben Affleck, Clay Aiken, assuming the roles of political and environmental activists?
Well, you know, I think it goes to the larger picture of do citizens have a responsibility? Just because, I mean, I tell my children, with knowledge comes responsibility. So if these people you mentioned are spreading information, and your listeners are hearing about it and then looking it up, the beauty of the internet, you can become informed. And then if you feel you can take action to influence our government or whatever government is listening to do something or support humanitarian agencies who are doing the job at considerable risk to themselves, I might add. I mean, an aid worker, one of UNICEF partners, was killed at the very site that I was just day before yesterday. So, you know, these are the heroes. They're doing the work, and I know money's tight everywhere, but if people can support them or influence the government to take a risk, you know, governments are just never going to do it because it's the right thing. You know, they'll do it for self-serving reasons or because it's financially efficient or, you know, in the interest of the government. But if there is pressure, I mean, I was part of a generation that we stopped a war. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but you know, it was campuses. It was.
I tried
campuses.
To stop the war.
It went on way long. But I do believe it was the people that stopped it. And my point was that we do have a voice.
Well, along these lines, a listener from Manhattan left a comment on our show page. He said, "I'm listening to Ms. Farrow's account and feel at a loss as to where to begin offering my assistance. Where would you say he should start?"
Depending on his circumstances, if you're able to support any of the aid agencies that are there, and call the government. I mean, a group that I'm a part of is a 1-800 genocide number, and while it was set up for Darfur, you can say anything to your legislators. It plugs you right into your state and government, your senators, your congresspeople, and just say, you know, I don't like what's going on in Congo, and I would like our government to be part of the solution. There's a 1-800 for UNICEF if you want to support UNICEF. They're there. You know, workers are putting their lives at risk for the I think it's the letter 1-800, the letter, the number for UNICEF is one of them. And you know, whatever your preferred aid group is, support them. And they are, I mean, if you took them out of the equation, there would be just a massive loss of human life. But that said, there has to be a political solution, because until there can be security in that region, the massive death toll of 5 million human beings will continue to rise.
What got you first involved in human rights work?
Same thing. You know, I heard it like your listener. I started hearing what was going on, and I was fortunate to be invited to join up with UNICEF years ago.
But this kind of work keeps you away from acting. Do you find it more fulfilling?
Much more. And it isn't even that. It's that I can't do anything else now. You know what I mean? I feel it's a moral imperative. My sense of outrage is such that I don't even want to act anymore. I want to be a part of the solution to, you know, to bring peace to these regions. You can't go there and see what I saw and hear the stories that I heard from women, from children, from child soldiers, and then just, okay, now I'm going to just go back to my life and forget about it. So it's you know, I'm on board.
And you've been not only an activist in terms of being a witness, but also in getting other people to also do something more activistic. Is that the word, activistic? Anyway.
More active, maybe.
Yeah.
Involved.
And are you going back to Darfur, or is Congo now, because Congo is such an incredible crisis, is that going to take over much of your energy these days?
No, you know, I think I'm just going to focus on children in conflict, I think. You know, I mean, yes, I'll never abandon the Darfur region or South Sudan or Central African Republic. I think you know that I've been there twice.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, that region of Africa will probably occupy me for as long as I live and as long as anyone will listen. So I really thank you for being a most excellent conduit. You've been a caring person who, I mean, I can rant in a room by myself, but that won't help. You know, I need you. So this is good. And for the people who've told me their stories, you know, to be able to convey them to you, Bernadette and the other women who've asked me to tell the tales, now I've told them.
And I thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but thank you again, Mia Farrow, for participating in today's underreported segment. It's I can't say it's a pleasure to hear these stories, but it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.